Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Somali Pirates, the U.S. President on the Road, and Gay Marriage on a Roll this week. There was Iowa, now Vermont. Off the Horn of Africa, a U.S. crew member told the pirate story.
There was four Somali pirates with AK-47s. We took one of them hostage in the steering gear room with us, and then the other three, the captain talked them into getting in the lifeboat, but now they got our captain lifeboat.
In Baghdad, President Obama told U.S. troops it's time for Iraqis to step up.
It is time for us to transition to the Iraqis. They need to take responsibility for their country and for their sovereignty.
A governor's veto falls, and Vermont becomes the fourth state to legalize gay marriage and the first to do so with a legislature's vote.
Those voting yes, 100. Those voting no, 49. 100 needed to pass. You have voted to override the veto. The House will come to order.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Are you locked on the pirate drama? Where is the country heading with gay marriage, the economy, with leadership in the world? With us to look at the news this week from Washington, Ruth Marcus, editorial writer and columnist for The Washington Post. Ruth, it's very good to have you back.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Also from Washington, Barbara Slavin, assistant managing editor at The Washington Times. She's author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies. Barbara, wonderful to have you back as well.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, we're joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ruth, and Barbara.
Barbara Slavin, take us first to this little lifeboat off the Horn of Africa. Lots of big stuff going on this week, but this story is just sort of endlessly gripping. What are the options for the United States here?
Oh, it's really a fascinating story, and it shows asymmetry at its best. I mean, you've got a bunch of pirates who have a little lifeboat that's running out of fuel, apparently has running out of all sorts of supplies. They're desperately trying to get to the shores of Somalia with an American captain hostage. Meanwhile, you've got an American destroyer, a flotilla of American ships arriving on the scene. But there isn't much they can do at this point that would not threaten the life of the captain. So we'll have to see what happens, whether the pirates get to take him back to shore, where they have perhaps 150 other foreign captives, and whether we have negotiations for a ransom. There was an incident overnight where the captain apparently jumped overboard, tried to get away, but was not able to. And so I think we're back where we started a day or so ago.
I mean, imagine his situation, Jack. Here he presumably had to somehow gain their trust to have enough freedom of movement to get overboard. Now he's back on that little lifeboat. I'm afraid they're going to have him tied up every which way. He may be out of easy chances here, if there were ever easy chances, Jack.
Yeah, and I have to wonder about the Navy. I mean, perhaps this happened at night, and they couldn't see that the fellow was overboard, and therefore was away from at least
was supposedly at night. But then, how close can they be? I mean, should they have Navy SEALs under this boat? Do they want to risk the captain getting killed?
No, I suppose not. I suppose not. It's a hostage crisis, but it is to talk about the return of the repressed. This has been, I think, nearly 200 years since the United States has had any incidents with pirates.
Two centuries, literally. And Ruth Marcus, the latest news we're seeing as we speak is the Associated Press reporting that the pirates, and there are a lot of them along that Somali coast, are now sending larger ships, including previously hijacked ships with their hostages on board, out to sea to serve as shields for this little enclosed lifeboat. What's the calculus here for the Obama administration? I mean, is this high on their screen, low on their screen? Is this a big deal in Washington?
It has to be high on their screen because it is such a gripping story, and therefore it has captured all of our attention. Mm. I want to say something about this that's going to be provocative, and I don't mean it to be not sympathetic to the captain and his family. Certainly, if I were on that little lifeboat, if that was my husband or my son or my brother on that lifeboat, I would want the United States government to do everything it could to save me as an American citizen. Mm. But frankly, this is not a sort of political act on the part of these pilot of these pirates. They are not terrorists in the political sense. This is an economic transaction. And what's happened is, as I understand it, and Barbara, who knows more about this, can check me if I'm wrong, these shipping companies have basically made the calculation that it is cheaper and easier for them to simply pay ransoms as a general matter as a cost of doing business. It's like a pirate tax. And rather than arm up their vessels, which would cost them more money and insurance and other sorts of fees, and protect themselves against pirates. So we're basically like the emergency room visits of the uninsured. They've decided, the shipping companies, not to fully protect themselves against pirates. And when terrible things like this happens, the Navy has to come to the rescue.
But for heaven's sakes, I mean, you've got international law against arming up merchant ships. You've got here food aid headed to Africa being intercepted. That's hardly a—I mean, the shipping business itself is commercial, but the cargo here hardly that. The taking, the piracy itself, Barbara, may not be a political act, but a response would certainly be political in a big hurry if we start to get U.S. military really involved in this somehow. We've been there before in Somalia.
Yeah, we have. I mean, the fundamental problem here is Somalia. This is a country that hasn't had a real functioning government for over two decades, and that's why you have things like this pirate industry, which has developed. And Ruth was absolutely right. These are not ideological terrorists. They're just out to make money. It's become a booming business. Some accounts say they've made $80 million off ransoms over the last year. But there has been a response. There is a NATO-led contingency of ships that are supposed to be protecting people. The problem is that it's such a huge area that there's no way that the protecting ships can be there when you need them all the time. And that's why this incident has occurred. Mm-hmm. But we actually did a big magazine piece a couple months back, and the piracy began, interestingly enough, in the mid-90s with food shipments that were being seized. These were international food aid shipments going to Somalia to help the starving people there, and the pirates started commandeering them and reselling the food. And so, you know, no good deed goes unpunished, and here we are now.
I've been on those streets in Mogadishu. It's wild, and now that wildness is out at sea, and it's very different when there's an American flag wrapped around it. It becomes political whether anybody likes it or not. Let's get a caller right here, Lou in Buffalo, New York. Lou, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking a call, Tom. Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, you know, we're spending gazillions on you know, the security element, Homeland Security, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you got our Navy out there right in the Indian Ocean. They know that this is a high volatile area. And I got to disagree with the woman there that just went on this dissertation about the lack of the insurance policy and rushing into the emergency room. It's a business. These are companies. They have every right. They have every right on international waters to take the most effective lanes.
Got it. But Lou, we got that absolutely. But what do you want there? Blood and thunder? I mean, the captain's in this little boat. How do you use a big destroyer in that surgical?
I feel that the Navy and the SEALs, that's what they're trained to do.
Yeah.
They got to get this guy free. He's our citizen. We expect the Navy and the specialty forces to react and get this job done.
Lou, we've got it. Jack Beatty, what do you say? Get the SEALs in there.
Well, again, I mean, the constraint is the captain's life. This is one man. This is a commercial venture on both sides. And I'd hate to see us get this get blown up into some major moment for the Obama administration. Piracy is an irritant, and it's a colorful one. It brings with it memories of the past and so on, but it's not a major affair of state. And then when you have people getting into it, I mean, the Wall Street Journal today, they say bomb the ports of Somalia. That would be grand, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that just be splendid? And then we bomb the ports, and of course that's not enough, and so we have to send in some more forces, and the forces get pinned down there. I mean, look, there are some problems you just have to skirt around. And it seems to me that, you know, Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt alike were able to arm merchant ships and in that way deter, or at least partially deter, submarines. And something like that, I think, is probably the direction in which the international community will have to go.
Maybe, but this thing definitely isn't over yet. One of the most interesting comments I heard this week was from Major General Tom Wilkerson. He's CEO of the U.S. Naval Institute in Annapolis. He was on Morning Edition yesterday talking about how, and we've heard this on this show, one solution is to go in and sort of gut their bases on the shore. Here's what Major General Wilkerson had to say.
There's no sword that's ever been invented that can't cut both ways. If you decide to use military force to move them out of their havens, then it's about destruction. And that will involve either boots on the ground or some type of accurate delivery of weapon systems. And either of those has the potential to include in the destruction civilians.
And now, here we are, the latest, just coming in, is that the captors want a ransom and they're ready to kill the captain if attacked, they say. Ruth, what's your prediction for politically how this plays out? Can Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, sort of pushed it to the side, kind of along Jack's lines? Do you think the White House can keep it there?
I'm not really sure, because the pressure is, this is an American citizen. The pressure is going to be on the White House to show that it's protecting an American citizen, or doing what it can to protect an American citizen. And I was listening to a bunch of conservative talk radio yesterday, and there's a lot already of, look, the Obama administration is weak, why it's not standing up to, and they were describing these pirates as terrorists. So it's all getting conflated there to some extent in the public mind.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Obama on the road, gay marriage on a roll, Somali pirates on a rampage with an American hostage. Ruth Marcus is with us from the Washington Post. Barbara Slavin from the Washington Times. Jack Beatty's here. I promise, pirates are not all we will talk about. There's a lot going on, but pirates are really on people's mind right now. Let's get a call from Detroit, Michigan. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi. Listen, I certainly hope that the captain is safe, but people need to know that those ships that go through Somalia's shipping lanes, they dump pollution, they dump toxic waste. They have trawlers that take all of their fish. They can't feed the people. I mean, I hear a lot of rambles out there, but these people have to eat.
Piracy's okay by you, Tim? Piracy?
The United States is founded on piracy. Great Britain is founded on piracy. I mean, come on, man. Check your history books, man. I mean, it sounds, if you don't know, you can make ignorant statements, but the United States, we got started by being pirates.
Yeah, we did have a little piracy back there in the day, but also been fighting pirates since way back when. And, Tim, thank you for your call. Let me get another perspective right here from Winchester, Massachusetts. Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
How's everything going?
It's okay. We're not in that little lifeboat, so it's okay. But if we're glad we're not.
I was very close friends with the guy that's on the lifeboat at one time.
The captain, Richard
really
Phillips?
Well. Yes.
From where, Jay?
We're from Winchester. He and I both were from Winchester.
What kind of guy is he? When you heard last night that he jumped overboard in the middle of the night, were you surprised?
Actually, I predicted it.
Why?
He's a... Two things about Richard. He had sort of a devil may care attitude about of life. You know, he was a guy that lived life to the fullest and enjoyed it. So he didn't have great compunctions about, you know, doing the best thing by himself, as he did just to, you know, trying to get out there and enjoy himself and try different things. He lived his life to the fullest, basically. And the other thing is, I think he would take great offense to having been captured and been taken off the boat. And I think he would probably try to do whatever he could to either get off the boat and escape the capture, or he may try to grab a gun and fight these guys. I mean, he he attacks life a little bit in that way, and he lives with gusto. I'm sure he's matured a little bit since him and I hung out together. But
no doubt in school days, and he's maturing, maybe aging right now. But you say look for more from the captain, and we've got to just hope and pray for him. Jay, thanks for that. We hope he gets off that boat and continues to live life to the fullest. Barbara, I want to crank the kind of context on up here. I mean, there we've got pirates, we've got a lifeboat, we've got cargo. Barack Obama was talking about big stuff, nuclear weaponry, very recently on this long trip. It was last Sunday. He was in Prague, crowd of 20,000 there in the Czech capital. He's talking about a world, never mind pirates, he's talking about a world free of nuclear weapons.
The United States will take concrete steps towards a world without nuclear weapons. To put an end to Cold War thinking, we will reduce the role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy and urge others to do the same. Make no mistake, as long as these weapons exist, the United States will maintain a safe, secure, and effective arsenal to deter any adversary. But we will begin the work of reducing our arsenal. We will negotiate a new strategic arms reduction treaty with the Russians this year.
The president on his big overseas trip. Barbara Slavin, what about it? What, each has got about 2,200 nuclear warheads now, want to get down to 1,500. Is that reasonable? Do the Russians look ready to even talk to the president about it? And what about his outreach to the Iranians in negotiating on the nuclear front?
Yeah, I mean, the piracy is very interesting, but let's talk about some of the bigger strategic stuff that's going on. It was quite a trip that the president embarked on between the G20, all the bilateral meetings, all the speeches, all the outreach. He met with the Russian president last week in London. They're going to begin serious talks now about a new strategic arms reduction treaty. The old one expires in December, and there is great hope that they will be able to make substantial progress and get a new one before then or be very close to that. This is important for a number of reasons. It sends a signal to countries like Iran that the United States is serious about living up to its obligations under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which say that you get to keep your nukes, but you're supposed to reduce the number. The goal is a nuclear-free world, and this is supposed to be an incentive to other nations not to build nuclear weapons of their own. So it's important on a number of levels.
Is Russia interested in this? Can we tell yet? Is Iran interested? I mean, there was some welcoming of this by I think Ahmadinejad, when he was at a uranium processing center or somewhere, like right in the middle
of
there.
It puts the U.S. on a kind of moral high ground in terms of dealing with the Iranians. And yes, the Russians are interested, primarily because they can't maintain their nuclear stockpile. And there really is no need for such large numbers of weapons. Now, there are details such as what do you do about Russian tactical nukes? What do you do about delivery systems? A lot of stuff to go through. But I think both sides are committed. In terms of Iran, the U.S. is just sending out message after message that it wants to engage. This week, it was announced by the State Department that the U.S. will be a full participant in multilateral talks with the Iranians on the nuclear program. This is something new.
First time.
The Bush administration basically said that Iran had to stop its nuclear program, stop its uranium enrichment before the U.S. would get involved in this way. Now, no preconditions. And an invitation has gone out to the Iranians to take part in talks. You have a funny reaction on the part of the Iranians. They're almost overwhelmed by all of these overtures. I think they're feeling a little bit surprised and not quite sure how to respond. So you had from Ahmadinejad a kind of dual response. On the one hand, he seemed interested and said Iran would engage if the U.S. was honest. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he's still trumpeting Iran's nuclear program, as he did the other day, saying that we have more centrifuges, 7,000 centrifuges now, and that they're opening a new nuclear fuel plant. Well, in fact, that plant has already been operating for some time, and there are some doubts about how many centrifuges are really spinning away. But the Iranians want to enter negotiations from a position of strength. So we have a little bit of a kind of foreplay going on now before the two actually sit down. But I think there will be negotiations.
Ruth Marcus, the president home from quite an enormous trip with many facets to it, many different audiences, many different issues. He was home by midweek after a surprise visit, just 4 hours, but nevertheless to Baghdad. How do you see him coming back to Washington? Is he strengthened by this? What's the reaction he's getting? Is there pure party coloring to the reaction, Ruth?
I thought it was, from the White House's point of view, a successful trip. I actually thought that much of the reporting on the trip sort of overplayed the degree of success. We all knew he was going to get a raucously joyful welcome in Europe, which was very glad to be rid of President Bush, and was obviously, we knew it from the campaign when he was a celebrity in Europe, was very enthusiastic about President Obama. So that President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama went to Europe and got a good reception was not in any way a surprise, but it was greeted as a big triumph in a lot of the press coverage. As a substantive matter, I think his results were way more mixed. He did not achieve a lot. It was not a series of summits where there were major achievements expected, nor were there major achievements brought home. And I thought it was a very good idea for him to go to Iraq to visit the troops. It's always a good idea for the president to show himself as commander-in-chief, to buck up the troops. I was very struck most of all by something he said during his 4 hours in Iraq, where he said to the troops, he thanked them for their service, and told them that they had done a remarkable thing, which was to help bring democracy to Iraq. And I was struck when he said this because I was thinking, gee, but if
Who's
President Obama
here?
Had had his way, then they wouldn't be there at all.
That was his campaign theme, of course. This was against dumb wars. He wouldn't have gone in. Let's go to Peter in Framingham, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, I appreciate you taking the call.
Sure.
I had a couple of comments.
Yeah.
I consider myself a very patriotic American. I'm a lifelong Democrat. And I was extraordinarily proud for the first time in decades to see my president on the world stage in behaving in a manner that I thought brought honor and acclaim to himself, to the country, to his whole administration, to do things, to reach out to the Europeans, to assert leadership in NATO that we have virtually turned our backs on for years, to travel to Turkey, to reach out to the entire Islamic world in a way that was credible and effective, and I thought highly significant, and particularly to combat exactly the issue of Islamic fundamentalism and associated terrorism, and meanwhile, you know, I don't think very many people noticed that he held a Seder in the White House this week.
Yes, he did, observing Passover.
Along for the members for Jewish members of his administration. This has been the last 60 days has been a time of extraordinary challenge, I think, for a new president. One could say unprecedented. I don't know when it's been like that in history.
And you're giving him a thumbs up, and we hear it loud and clear right across that range. Thank you, Peter. Let me get one more right here from Woodward, Iowa. Danielle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think the pirates are a distraction. I am more focused on the $85 billion requested by Obama to maintain Iraq and Afghanistan efforts. And I'm also looking at programs like Frontline, which I take seriously, talking about health care that's not accessible to Americans. And I'm waiting for a reaction from your guests. I think the health care industry is immoral. And I'm wondering what this war effort is costing us against a theoretical exogenous threat when we have real dangers here in this country towards human life that are fostered upon us by corporate malfeasance.
We've definitely got trouble at home. Danielle, I hear that, and I want to get to Jack Beatty. Jack, look at this global tour, and at the same time, Danielle is quite right. At home, we've got a lot on our plate. Obama, as a senator, was against this special spending on Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, as president, his spokesman said this week, well, we've got to do it one last time in this way. But you hear Danielle's complaint.
Well, I join with Peter in just being very proud of the president. I thought it was a terrific trip, the symbolism, his presence, his grace, gestures, shaking hands with the Bobby at 10 Downing Street.
Yeah, that was good.
I mean, you know, that's America.
That's
American. We don't
just
pass by people as if they're not there. I thought that was just wonderful. Now, small things, of course. You know, the president said, I do not buy the notion that America can't lead the world, but we exercise our leadership best when we are listening. I think that's the post-Bush mode of our foreign policy. We approach the world now in the shadow of two disasters, the wreckage of our foreign policy of imperialism and war, and the wreckage of our financial system and our plan for global capitalism, which is pull the world economy down. The idea that we're going to go and lecture the Europeans, the idea that somehow we're going to convince them, for example, to put more effort into Afghanistan when they see that for the cul-de-sac it is, I just think that's not on. We're not going to be convincing people. We're going to be joining them. And that's partly because our estate is shrunken. And it's also partly because, as Barack Obama is aware, you know, it isn't just Churchill and Roosevelt meeting in a room anymore where they decide on the architecture of the post-war world. There are all sorts of players here, and they have to be accommodated. And, you know, and as to Danielle's point, you know, when you think about it, just think in terms of relative threat. More Americans are at risk of drowning in a bathtub than they are of being victims of terrorism. And yet we are spending billions against terrorism. We're fighting two wars, and one of them, the one in Iraq, just a total divergence even from the main one, and the main one, the one in Afghanistan, as dubious an enterprise as we've ever taken, step forward in. So
that debate goes on. I got to say, I remember 9/11 a little more vividly than a bathtub, but I take your point. I want to talk about Ted Stevens for a minute and the U.S. Attorney General backing off in that case on Wednesday. Eric Holder sat down with Katie Couric at CBS. She asked what he would say to the former Alaska Senator, Ted Stevens, whose federal ethics conviction was overturned following accusations of criminal wrongdoing in the Department of Justice on the case.
I would tell Senator Stevens and I would tell the American people that I looked at this case as quickly as I could. I was disturbed by what I saw, and I took action as quickly as I could with regard to what I thought the appropriate thing for the Justice Department to do was. To the extent that there are other things that need to be examined, Judge Sullivan has ordered such an inquiry. We will do an internal inquiry ourselves.
Ruth Marcus, what a reversal. What does this mean for the Department of Justice?
It's going to be a really interesting time at the Justice Department. It's impossible to overstate what a huge deal it is for the Attorney General to essentially pull the plug on a prosecution because of prosecutorial misconduct. And it's a very big deal for Eric Holder, who, as a young lawyer, was part of the public integrity section, the very part of the Justice Department that, ironically, is accused of not having had the integrity to have conducted the trial under fair rules, which is the issue that prosecutors are morally and legally and ethically bound to turn over evidence that might be helpful to the defense. And there is a lot of evidence that the prosecutors in this case failed to do that. This week, we knew that. This week, not only did the judge say that he wanted an independent investigation of this, but the Attorney General moved to install a new head of the Office of Professional Responsibility, which is another part of the Justice Department that looks at the ethical behavior and sort of polices the ethical behavior of prosecutors. And I think that was a very, very positive sign from the new Justice Department.
Ruth, we've got 10 seconds, but in a nutshell, why would they have gone out of bounds here? It was President Bush's Department of Justice. It was a Republican senator.
Well, the
why not play by the rules?
If people did not play by the rules, and we were actually talking at our family Seder because my sister-in-law happens to be a federal prosecutor, you know, how just rogue it is to do that. If people didn't play by the rules, it wasn't a matter of ideology. It was a matter of wanting very badly to win.
I I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Also in the headlines this week, Italy's earthquake healing in Binghamton, New York. And the first pitch comes out on opening day. Italy holds a state funeral today for earthquake victims. One survivor described the devastation.
It took generations to build. It took 40 seconds to be destroyed. 40 seconds of hell.
At an interfaith service in Binghamton, New York, the 13 victims shot dead at an immigration center were remembered in prayer and song. And lifelong Red Sox fan Senator Ted Kennedy, battling brain cancer throughout the season's first pitch this week at Fenway Park, the crowd loved it.
Would you please welcome the senior senator from Massachusetts, the Honorable Edward M. Kennedy.
The Red Sox beat the Tampa Bay Rays 5-3. Passover Seder in the White House this week. It's Good Friday. Right now, we're looking at a big week in the news. The president on the road oversees gay marriage. On a roll and more. Ruth Marcus is here from the Washington Post. Barbara Slavin from the Washington Times. Our own Jack Beatty. Let's get a call here from LeClaire, Iowa. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a Catholic straight woman from Iowa, and I couldn't be prouder of the Supreme Court decision here in Iowa to legalize gay marriage. I urge people to get online and read the decision because it just beautifully explicates why, in a civil rights context, based on our Constitution, the court held that we cannot treat gay and lesbian people as being that much different from heterosexual people. So it's a court decision that's not based on the polls or what's politically feasible.
How's it going down with your neighbors, Kathy? You're on for it. What are you hearing from around Iowa?
Well, I was in a group setting on Friday night after the opinion came out at a church in Davenport that was packed with people in support of the ruling, many, many, many long-standing gay couples. There are many, many gay couples already living in Iowa who've been in long-term relationships with children. And there's a great group here, oneiowa.org, which I would recommend to people that's been working and organizing around this issue. And I love the idea that we're all one. We're all the same, ultimately. And Iowa has this great tradition legally, which I was not aware of until I read the opinion, of being many, many years ahead of the country on saying that slave rights should be upheld and segregation. We were far ahead of the 1954 decision.
Kathy, we've got it. You're sailing that direction and happy to be so. And, of course, Vermont moving there this week as well. Jack, I want to get you on this. I've got a comment here from Twitter. On Point Radio, again, you can get us there. Or on Facebook, says, 13 years, my partner and I have worked, paid taxes, cared for each other. A new straight couple can marry and have more rights overnight. Fair? Question mark. On the other hand, Jack, Ruth, Barbara, here's the National Organization for Marriage, a group opposed to gay marriage. Advertisement out this week in reaction to the decisions in Iowa and Vermont in the ad. Actors liken gay marriage to a coming storm.
There's a storm gathering.
The clouds are dark. And the winds are strong.
And I am afraid.
Some who advocate for same-sex marriage have taken the issue far beyond same-sex couples.
They want to bring the issue into my life.
My freedom will be taken away.
I'm a California doctor who must choose between my faith and my job.
I'm part of a New Jersey church group punished by the government because we can't support same-sex marriage.
Jack Beatty, I want to get you on. Let me get Craig in Omaha, Nebraska here first. Craig, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, I just looking at it from a point of opening up a can of worms. A lot of discrimination suits in the courts because it's actually a lifestyle, and they're saying, okay, go ahead with this lifestyle. But what about the Mormons that say, hey, wait a second, I want to have three wives. You're discriminating against me, or somebody else might say, you know, I want to marry my brother or my sister, whatever. But I just look and think that it's just going to open up a lot of can of worms for everybody saying, wait a second, my lifestyle, now I want to do it my way, so let me get married, you know?
Craig, we've got it. Jack Beatty, how are you looking out on this? You're right across the river there from Vermont. I'm sure you've watched what's been going on there all week long. And here it is, you know, Iowa and Vermont. Now, there's states 3 and 4 where gay marriage, legal.
Yes, and the significance of Vermont, this was done by state legislators. They voted it. It was the first time that happened.
Not a court.
not a court, not unelected judges, and several had to change their votes. They actually risked their careers to vote on this. You know, my wife went into a store in White River Junction where the proprietor has a long-term relationship with a partner, and the woman looked very happy. It was around noon, and Lois said, well, what's going on? And the woman said, it's a better world today. And for all who believe in equality, it is a better world today. A Corinth resident, Corinth town up here, Linda Weiss, who proposed marriage to her partner while they were driving to the State House in Montpelier, she said, it was quite amazing. I was grateful to be there. It's true, the things that opponents do fear, that marriage normalizes us. It's true because we are normal. We're here. We've always been here. We'll always be here. You know, the future is just so clear. The demography here is destiny. The younger voters are, the more likely they are to support this. As soon as the current generation passes on to its reward, gay marriage, it'll be a fight. But the 14th Amendment, the equal protection of the laws clause of the 14th Amendment, is at war with all those state constitutional amendments passed in 2004 and 6. And eventually, they will be overturned.
Ruth Marcus, but you hear Craig in Omaha, and he says, can of worms here. Lifestyle, we do this. What next? Polygamy?
I don't have a lot of patience, really, with the can of worms argument, because you could use that, say, to argue that you opened up a can of worms when you passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and made it illegal to discriminate against people in hiring on the basis of race. If you have a law, there will be litigation over it. I think it's very easy to distinguish marriage from marriage between two people from polygamy or incest or other things, which nobody in reality is pushing for. I think it is the civil rights issue of our time. Two things are very interesting. One is, as Jack pointed out, the real significance of Vermont is that this was not imposed by a court, which more and more courts are doing, but it was voted by a legislature over a gubernatorial veto. The thing that's interesting is the disconnect between where this seems to be going and the mainstream, to some extent, of both political parties. If you remember, both President Obama and during the Democratic presidential campaign secretary, then Senator Clinton, said they were opposed to gay marriage. Well, there are lawsuits now against the federal government that challenge, among other things, the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, signed, incidentally, by President Clinton, that challenge its constitutionality in refusing to recognize marriages from states such as Massachusetts and the others for federal law purposes. And President Obama is going to face a tough choice as the former constitutional law professor that he is.
Let's go to Harry in Rockingham, Vermont. Vermont, of course, where the legislature took its vote this week. Harry, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I was up at the local emporium, and frankly, I understand there's a quiet poll in the state of Vermont, and I disagree with Jack Beatty, that 65% of Vermonters did not want this law on the books.
A quiet poll, like a public opinion poll. Has it been published?
Right.
I mean, is it out there?
Right. They took a poll, but it was never mentioned in the media.
Well.
And 65% of Vermonters did not want this law on the book. In fact, they wanted a referendum.
It sounds like you may be one of those in that 65%. How do you feel about it, Harry?
Well, how do I feel about it? I think it's ridiculous.
What about the equal rights argument? These are American citizens.
The whole concept of same-sex marriage, please. I mean, I just disagree with it 100%. I think it's a distraction. I think we got more economic problems in this state, like every state, and we should be concentrating on that.
You think it's a done deal for Vermont, though, or do you expect voter pushback?
Well, it's a done deal. They got it on the books, even though the governor vetoed it. They overrode his veto yesterday, and in fact, a lot of these people came into the state from out of state, lived here, and then got elected to the legislature, which is not being brought out.
Of course, that makes them Vermonters if they live there and get elected. I mean, this is a country where people move around, right?
Well, that's true, but Vermont is kind of a special state on a lot of things, but I feel that a lot of the old-time Vermonters that are living here are absolutely, I know just from talking to, to them, that are absolutely against this, absolutely.
Harry, we hear you loud and clear. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Rhinebeck, Iowa. We've got Iowa and Vermont really in the news here this week and the end of last. Dee Dee, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling from rural Rhinebeck, Iowa, and I just wanted to let you know and everyone who's listening know that there are a lot of us who are very, very excited about the new ruling on same-sex marriages. And, you know, we've received quite a bit of negative press recently because of some really poor decisions regarding immigrants here in Iowa. We've had lots of ICE raids, and people are being chased out of the state.
On the meatpacking factories, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And quite frankly, not only would I like to see same-sex couples come to Iowa to get married, but I would really like for them to take a look around and even consider staying here. You know, there's a beautiful acreage down the road from me for sale, and I would love to have a same-sex couple with children buy it and really make a great life for themselves.
Now, exactly why, Dee Dee, exactly why do you feel that way? Is it a celebration of rights, or what is it?
Well, I think that, you know, here in Iowa, we have a rapidly aging population, and we really need people to consider to move to Iowa. And, you know, why not same-sex couples?
Yeah, we've got it. We've got it. We've got it loud and clear. Let's go to Gerald in Greenville, South Carolina. Gerald, you're on the air.
Hi. How you doing, Tom? Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
You know, I'm listening to the thing about the gay rights, and I do oppose the assimilation with civil rights because, you know, I do have the choice to choose who I have sex with, but I don't have the choice whether I'm black or white the way I come into this country. And when do we get rights because of which party we have sex with? And, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah was decided in the Bible as a, you know, as an abomination in the sight of God. And as a Christian, I think it's just one more step with you know, what we've fallen into with materialism, that we're getting ready to fall into one more trap.
But Gerald, what do you say to people? I mean, I hear you. It's unmistakable what you're saying. Are you African-American, Gerald?
Yes.
And so, and I mean, what about people who say, well, this is as much a part as of who I am as the color of my skin is? What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I can see it's a part of who they are, but, you know, like I said, this country was founded on Christian principles, and the farther we get away from them, the more we get what we're getting right now, which is economic demise and the rest of, you know, we've got suicides, we've got things going on. And because we're getting farther from God and what is, you know, what the Bible says.
Gerald, we've got it. We appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I'm curious, on both sides of the argument, how much of this is just semantics? If civil unions awarded all the same rights as marriage, would either side of the argument have a problem with that? And I'll take the response off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, that's interesting. Jack Beatty, civil unions, of course, Vermont was there very early on. And
yes,
so was Barack Obama.
So was Barack Obama, absolutely. Well, of course, proponents of gay marriage say it isn't the same. The dignity of the word isn't the same. And that there are also some issues of benefits and rights that I'm not entirely clear about. But that it is not equal protection of the laws to say one category can have marriage and then the other category, because of this really invidious reason of sexual orientation, can't have the same rights. That's not equal protection of the law. That's separate but equal.
And there are a lot of real-world consequences, the tax rates that you pay, the Social Security benefits that you get. There's about 1,000 federal laws and regulations that make distinctions based on marriage. So it's not simply a matter of semantics that could solve the problem, nor do I think some of the folks who oppose gay marriage would be particularly happy to have a civil union regime in every state.
Much more to come on that subject. I want to just touch the economy. Larry Summers, top economic advisor in the White House, speaking this week at the Economic Club of Washington, optimistically about positive signs he says he's seeing in the economy now.
The sense of a ball falling off a table, which is what the economy has felt like since the middle of last fall, I think we can be reasonably confident that that's going to end within the next few months and that you'll no longer have that sense of free fall.
Maybe not. It wasn't an easy appearance there. Demonstrators came up on the stage, unfurled a big sign behind Lawrence Summers saying, "We want our money back," and shouted for his resignation. Ruth, what about the sense of the economy? Markets up this week, closed today for Good Friday, but a sense of turning around or still who knows here?
Well, he didn't exactly say what happens to the ball when it stops the free fall. It could roll along the floor for a while or it could bounce back. And one thing I think that is true and is going to be of increasing importance as we get closer to another election is that as the economy hopefully and probably slowly recovers, one of the things that will lag in that recovery is the unemployment rate and job growth. So even closer to the election in 2010, we are going to probably still see whether or not that ball is tumbling, pretty high rates of unemployment. The flip side of that for the Obama administration is that the public seems to actually have a remarkable amount of patience in terms of understanding that this is a very deep hole and it's going to take quite a long time to get out of it.
Barbara Slavin, we literally just have half a minute here, but Jack was talking earlier about the U.S. Standing and reputation, model in the world. Whole world is watching us try to deal with our economy now. Do you still, in Obama's trip, did you still see the world looking to the U.S. for leadership or turning away?
I think it was a combination. I think Obama was very clear that the world is now being governed in a collective way, that the U.S. is no longer perhaps as dominant as it was, and the world is going to have to get used to that.
Barbara Slavin with The Washington Times, author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. Barbara, it's always great to have you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Ruth Marcus at The Washington Post. Same to you, Ruth. Just great to have you here. Thank you so much for being
Thanks
along.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend, sir.
Same to you, my friend.
And happy holidays to all in this week, from Seder's to Good Friday and right on to Easter. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or at Twitter and Facebook. We're On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.